Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining our live stream and spending time with us today. Since the middle of July, volatility has gradually returned to financial markets. But what started as a bumpy rotation out of technology stocks into more cyclical areas of the market intensified and broadened last Friday. The last trigger was a jobs report headlined by disappointing job growth and an uptick in the employment rate. This has intensified the unwinding of positions that had been successful since the beginning of the year, the most significant one being the unwind of the yen carry trade. Yen rallied more than 10% in the last month against the US dollar as Bank of Japan hiked interest rates while traders baked in Fed rate cuts. The sell-off has been the most violent in sectors which have done the best, such as tech, especially artificial intelligence. As a reaction, not only did the S&P lose more than 5% in the last two sessions, but more significantly, we have seen the whole yield curve come down more than 50 basis points in the last week. The 70 basis points decline in the two-year Treasury yield in the last week is the most we have seen since the SVB crisis last March. There is now over 230 basis points of Fed rate cuts priced in through 2025, the most priced into the market before a first cut has even taken place, when we look at the past 30 years. So today, with the market dynamics shifting and uncertainty elevated, we wanted to bring our team together to take a step back and provide a sober view of the economy, markets, and how to position going forward. And maybe I will just give the punchline up front. Yes, we have to acknowledge that risks have increased, which is why now, as is always the case, it's important to be diversified and have a portfolio that's aligned with your goals and risk tolerance. But at the same time, if you have that foundation in place, we don't believe it is time to panic. In fact, we still believe the economy is on relatively solid footing, and we believe there are some interesting opportunities emerging from the dislocation caused by this sell-off. So to help me unpack all of this, I'm pleased to be joined today by three of my colleagues: Jason Dreho, Head of Asset Allocation Americas, David Lefkowitz, Head of U.S. Equities, and Leslie Falconio, Head of Taxable Fixed Income Strategy. All right, everyone. Great to see you here. We've been talking a lot over the last 24 hours, or more like since Friday, about this topic. Jason, I'm going to start with you. As I mentioned, we still don't believe a recession is imminent. You wrote extensively about this, actually, in the last 2 years when there was a lot of calls for the big R, which died down for a while, but now it's back in vogue. So we're still of the view that, soft landing is possible. Can you expand on the rationale behind this and some of the variables we're watching closely?
Well, ultimately, I'd say our soft landing kind of thesis is premised on the idea that consumer spending, which is the biggest part of the economy, and the labor market, they'll cool and they have cooled, but they won't crack. And let's start with the labor market. You alluded to, how on the July jobs report that we got on Friday was disappointing. That kind of was the catalyst for the markets to start to sell off on Friday, and it's continued today. But if you look at the labor market really over the past couple of years, what we've seen, again, is a labor market that was incredibly tight 2 years ago, and it's cooled down. It's now much more in balance, very similar to where it was right prior to the pandemic. Now, much of this rebalancing has happened because of labor supply increasing rather than demand destruction. And this is critical for assessing what is actually going on in the market, how much further it could weaken. So another data point that came out on Friday was that the unemployment rate went up from 4.1% to 4.3%. The low last year was 3.4%. So this is a pretty sizable move higher than the unemployment rate. It's often the case that investors, when you see this kind of move higher, it continues to go higher. And that's sort of like a prelude to recession. And that's kind of like heightened recession concerns. But if you look at the demand for labor, it still remains quite strong. And a simple way to look at that is companies may be moderating their hiring, but they still have hired 2.5 million people over the past year based on payroll growth. Initial jobless claims that measure how many people are getting let off remain very low. And so we're seeing companies that are slowing hiring, but also really reluctant to lay off workers. In an environment where the economy is still growing well and profits overall are good, and David will probably talk about how earnings this year for the S&P 500 companies are good, smaller companies being impacted more, but overall profit growth is good, companies lay off workers as kind of last resort. It's why the labor market is a lagging indicator. And therefore, if companies aren't really feeling the squeeze, you're not going to see the uptick in layoffs. Now, that feeds into consumer spending that's held up reasonably well. If the labor market's good, consumer spending should be good, and vice versa. That kind of it's itself fulfilling kind of a dynamic. And yes, consumer spending has moderated. There's a lot of anecdotes during earnings season of companies kind of, you know, pulling back or seeing the consumer pull back. But the macro data on retail sales that we have through June, other spending, still suggests ultimately consumer spending is normalizing, it's not deteriorating. So we look at all the data in aggregate for the labor market and the consumer, it's really hard to pinpoint exactly why suddenly things kind of grind to a halt very quickly. You know, certainly over time, but in the near term, that just seems to us kind of a relatively low risk. And if the Fed's able to cut rates, that should kind of ensure the soft landing. That's really the crux of why we feel pretty comfortable with the soft landing still.
Yeah, you just mentioned Fed. I mean, the biggest challenge obviously weighing on the economy is the restrictive monetary policy. You know, you're seeing many in our industry believe the Fed is behind the curve in cutting interest rates. You know, we're even hearing calls for an emergency cut. Maybe that's a little bit premature, but that said, even our thinking has evolved over the past few days. We were calling for a 25 basis points cut starting in September. We have moved that to 50 basis points last Friday. So can you talk through how the Fed could respond from here?
Well, to answer that question, let's go back to last Wednesday when the Fed had its meeting. They did sort of as expected. They didn't raise rates or cut rates, but they kind of guided to, you know, the quite likely that they'll cut rates in September as long as inflation data doesn't kind of really surprise to the upside. So after the Fed meeting, our takeaway was now this looks like we're more confident in a 25 basis point cut in September, another one in December. This is before we got the payrolls report on Friday, as well as an ISM manufacturing data on Thursday that was disappointing. Jobless claims ticked up. So the data post the Fed meeting was disappointing, exacerbated kind of the growth concerns, in particular the labor market, because the Fed has a dual mandate. It's price stability, kind of bringing inflation down to 2%, but also full employment. For a long time, the past 2 years, they've been able to focus entirely on inflation, raise rates, cool the economy, bring inflation down, because the labor market was really tight. Well, now, as I alluded to, the labor market is cooled. It's kind of gotten more back in balance. And now the Fed even explicitly said they're kind of cognizant of both risks and they're sort of giving kind of equal weight to both parts of the mandate. Now, that was on Wednesday. The data since has gotten worse. So the reason why we adjusted our forecast to expect 100 basis points of cuts this year, and you know, which is starting with 50 in September, is this change in the market dynamics and the economics. Now, the market's pricing even more aggressive cuts. It's almost more like almost five cuts this year, or actually almost even more than that. So very significant. But ultimately, I think there's three main reasons why the Fed, we think, will be willing to cut. One, in June, when they are forecasting the year-end level of the unemployment rate, they were predicting then 4%. We're already at 4.3%, and the inflation is on target to meet their goals. And the trend is higher for unemployment, so therefore, if you're going to act, now is the time to act. That's number one. Number two, Powell explicitly said in his press conference after the meeting announcement on Wednesday that the committee is, you know, believes the labor market has loosened enough, they don't want it loosened anymore. Well, the data since then says it's loosened even more. So if that's the case, they should become kind of proactive and start to move rates. And then you can get into more technical weeds of like kind of rules of how you should set monetary policy. All those rules say that the Fed should already have been starting to cut rates. And so that would further kind of exacerbate that they're behind the curve. So you add it all up. I think that, you know, it's very, very likely they will cut in September. The real kind of question is like, how much do they cut? We think they'll go and be kind of aggressive, like get to neutral quickly. But it is going to be data dependent. If a jobs report in for August bounces back and is strong, maybe they only do 25. If it's weak, I think that further cements not only 50, but maybe even subsequent 50 cuts at other meetings.
Okay, thanks, Jason. David, I want to bring you in. At the most, well, not the most exciting, fixed income is even more, I don't know, they're equally exciting these days. I love all my kids the same. So the S&P 500 is off 8% from its highs, approaching to that 10% correction territory. Is this an overreaction, underreaction, just about right, given the economic picture that Jason just outlined?
Yeah, in our view, Salita, this, you know, we do think this is a bit of an overreaction. I mean, if you look at what we heard from earnings season from corporate America, it was generally favorable. Now Jason talked a bit about some of the weakness that we did see in some of the parts of the consumer. But that's still largely concentrated at the low end of the consumer. If we look at consumer spending more broadly, you know, you can look at what the banks said, you can look at what the credit card company said. they're not really seeing any material, broader-based pullback in consumer spending, which makes sense because the job market is still relatively healthy. Let's not forget, we still added jobs last month, and some of the most cyclical parts of the labor market, such as construction, and we're still adding jobs there. So I think that's pretty encouraging. So look, I think a lot of their valuations had gotten pretty elevated, and we hadn't seen any kind of volatility in some time. And so, we know these are equity markets, right? So equity volatility is really part of the story. And the positioning, especially with this unwinding of the yen carry trade, I think is just exacerbating things. So the sell-off does look a bit overdone, but I do think it's crucial in terms of what Jason talked about, that we probably do need to see Fed rate cuts. That seems to be the primary thing that is weighing on the economy, these restrictive levels of interest rates. And that can be changed pretty quickly by the Fed. The other important point here is that we don't really see big imbalances in the economy that need to be unwound, which is also encouraging. And private sector balance sheets are in pretty good shape. So it looks a bit overdone, but I would say the Fed probably does need to act.
Okay. So going back to even before last week's job report, there were growing concerns around technology stocks because some of the high-profile earning results failed to meet expectations. Granted, we said maybe expectations were too high, but nonetheless, it is a market. And people have started to question if the monetization of artificial intelligence applications will justify all of this upfront investments we have seen. NVIDIA, for example, is down 25% from its very highs. There were some articles over the weekend about prominent investors sending letters to their investors talking about this. What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, so when it comes to the tech area, I think this is where we are seeing some more emerging opportunities. I would think bear a couple things in mind. First, the tech sector is one of the highest quality sectors of the market. You can look at return on capital, you can look at the margin profile, you can look at the stability of the earnings, especially for certain cohorts. And if we're in this late cycle environment, which we still think we are in for the most part, then that's an area where I think people will gravitate towards. On the AI monetization, I personally think these fears are a little bit premature. Everything we heard from the tech companies themselves, and also broader, if you just look at broad corporate America, nobody is slowing down in terms of their investment in AI. You heard that from all the Magnificent Seven companies. Capital spending was increased for a number of them. And I think there's a recognition by management teams and frankly investors as well that it is going to take some time for the payoff from these investments to materialize. I think that's more of a question for maybe next year and beyond. We need to start seeing a path to monetization. But I think at this point, it's too early. I would also say we still think it's a supply-constrained market. That was one of the messages coming from the tech companies, that they don't have enough access to the AI chips. So that just implies that the demand is still quite robust. So we think the trends here are still very much intact. Obviously, these had been massive performers in so far, really, the last couple of years. But now, look, if you look at the Mag 7, they're trading at the lowest valuations in about a year and a half, trading at a mid-20s multiple for still very attractive growth, high returns on capital, and we think the AI story has not been derailed.
Okay. So I think I'm going to ask the same question a couple times in today's call, because this is all we talked about as a group, right? Lots of moves in the market. Our base case for the economy hasn't changed. We're still calling for a soft landing based on a potential Fed put, or cut starting in September. That said, there's been really big moves in the market. So there's certain things we want to maybe double down on or just buy because now they're cheaper than a couple weeks ago, and then other things that are more expensive, maybe not so much in equity markets, but more expensive than they were, so we want to maybe trim down. In equities, what are the opportunities are you leaning into? Based on what I heard on tech, let me just ask it more bluntly. Should we double down on tech? Or is it better to be patient and wait until the market, you know, stabilizes? Is, I guess, the first part. Mm-hmm. Second part is oil is down, mm-hmm. You know, quite a bit over the last few weeks as well. You are focusing on tech, but is this also a good time for us to take another look at energy sector? Because even though it outperformed tech in the most recent sell-off, everything outperformed, I guess, tech. And it might be an interesting place.
Yeah, so I think using the framework of this high-quality framework, I think it still makes the most sense. And because, again, I do think it's fair to say the economic environment, the economic backdrop is still... it's still uncertain, and we don't know precisely how much the economy is going to slow down, how much the Fed is going to ultimately cut rates, how quickly they're going to do that. So I think focusing on companies with strong balance sheets that have, you know, good growth opportunities, I think that makes a lot of sense, and that does lead, you know, that does lead you to the tech companies. I don't know if I would say we're doubling down, but I do think, you know, adding to positions in areas where there has been some pullback, I think makes a lot of sense. You know, we also do like some of the industrial area where, you know, things have been somewhat depressed for some time, and we think, especially if we get rate cuts, you know, then we should start to see some better trends there as well. Now, with respect to energy specifically, I think it's a little bit early to be getting aggressive on energy. I think, you know, again, in this late cycle environment, economic uncertainty, if we do slip into that recessionary scenario, which is not what we're thinking, then energy companies are not going to be, you know, you're just going to worry about demand for oil mm-hmm. prices. I would also highlight, look, we still have a lot of supply, right? OPEC is withholding a lot of barrels from the market. So there is sort of this supply-demand imbalance that OPEC is managing. But given the overall economic uncertainty, I'm not sure I'd be getting that aggressive on energy stocks at the moment.
Okay, thank you. So even though over the last, you know, 30 days, you know, WTI is down 12% or $10, it makes sense to be more patient in the cyclical parts of the equity market. Yeah. Maybe we'll talk with Jason a bit later from a portfolio asset allocation perspective if there's anything to be done on purely on oil. But tech, where a lot of people were worried more about valuation, is really where the opportunities are emerging, and mainly for you know, the high quality aspect of it. Okay, great. Leslie, let's bring you in. You know, there has been plenty of action in the bond markets as well. 10-year yields are down sharply since the jobs report, moving below 3.8%. Yield curve briefly turned upward sloping for the first time in over 2 years. Now I think it's back as we speak. But what's next?
That's a great question. To your point, I mean, we had the 2s10s go to a basis point, actually, which is, after 2 years of inversion, I know a basis point doesn't seem like a lot, but it's actually quite meaningful. And you know, we've had on what we call this bull steepener, because our belief was that yields would come down and it'd be led by the short end coming down. I mean, obviously, the magnitude that we've seen, particularly from Friday, this isn't like, you know, a gross scare, it's a gross shock. You know, we had the Fed funds pricing in about 50 basis points about 3 weeks ago. This morning we were 136 basis points of cuts for 2024. So that is a very, very large move. But when you have these kinds of unwinds, particularly when people are doing a flight to quality or flight to safety, you don't really know where that end is. So you're, because people at that point are looking for just capital preservation and principal protection. You know, we think, you know, overall, you know, we've been bullish. We think this is a little bit overdone here, but we would take a step back just to see how this plays out for the next day or so. But overall, I mean, our view has been more than likely, given the fact we do think it's a soft landing, you know, household purchasing power is still there. We're seeing a little bit of weaker data, but not weak. You know, our expectation is the yield curve will continue to steepen, but not necessarily have Treasury yields go all the way to, say, 3% by the end of the year. And more than likely, once this settles, you'll start to move up a little bit.
Okay. You know, when, I guess, rates were in 4.25%, 4.5% range, we were very vocal that investors had a great opportunity to add to high-quality fixed income. Let's maybe revisit that now after such a big move lower in the yields. Would you still be adding to fixed income right now? And What areas should we lean into? Let me put it another way, same way I asked David.
Yeah.
Okay? What are we cutting short? What are we adding more to, given the moves?
We've been, the fixed income market has had spread compression this year, and then it did move, right? So all we had was tight spreads and very, very low volatility within, the lower quality fixed income, say, high yield or those sectors with higher credit embedded. They haven't done anything. Obviously, lately, given the movement that we've seen in the equity market, we're seeing some volatility in that sector. For 5 months, we didn't have high yield move more than 40 basis points. Yesterday it moved about 35 or Friday. More than likely, it's going to widen out a little bit more. But given the fact that our view is for a soft landing, opportunistically, we might take advantage of this volatility and add to maybe some of those lower quality sectors. It's not that we would shed.
And high yield?
Yes, in the high yield side. I mean, it's not as though we're going to watch it for a bit, but I do think that most of the, fixed income, high quality will continue to do well. But now it's time we want to take a look at the lower quality. And one thing I want to caveat with that is, it's important to remember, even on the high yield side, if we look at what happened in SVB, high yield widened about 120 basis points in 3 days. It hasn't done any of that. It's maybe it might be 40, 50, might end up 70 basis points wider. So this isn't some sort of, financial catalyst that we're experiencing. It's just simply the market pricing in, a very slow growth environment, right now with the concern that we have a hard landing. So we do expect a lot of this to retrace as the numbers, are printed the next couple of months.
Okay. And then, Liz, we were talking about overreaction, underreaction with David a second ago. You spent a good portion of your career in a hedge fund, in a portfolio manager role, maybe more actively trading than we would be doing today. But tell me a little bit about how fear, on a day like this, takes over and maybe leads to overreactions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we look at something that's happened overseas, people forget that the yield curve has not only been inverted for 2 years, but we've had a Fed that's been on hold for a year. So if you're a hedge fund, our borrowing rate is very, very expensive, right? So if you're inverted, you want to borrow at A and invest in A minus 100 basis points. So they try and find alternatives to do that. And when we have such large moves, as we saw this past week, and as I mentioned, you've gone from 50 basis points of cuts down to almost 136 basis points of cuts, some of that arbitrage, if you will, gets sort of squeezed away. And because of that, you have a tendency to sell assets. And when you do that, okay, the fear factor comes in, then other people join in, and it sort of snowballs. And that's really what we're seeing in terms of some of the market reaction that we've seen today and on Friday. It's one of these, we have these big events when you have these really large moves. And plus, let's not forget, everyone sees the headline risk that constantly scrolls that keeps, a lot of investors a little bit on edge. So it's really just kind of that snowball going through.
Okay, great. Jason, coming back to you, markets globally and across asset classes are experiencing huge moves, like I said before. It's not just in the United States. Japanese equities were down over 12% overnight. And in some cases, prices moving opposite to maybe, what might be expected. For example, gold is down today when it should be benefiting from a flight to safety, right? So can you unpeel that for us a little bit? Why is this happening? And more importantly, where are these moves, creating opportunities?
So I think to kind of get a perspective of what's going across kind of financial markets globally, you kind of start with kind of a premise that for the past year or two, there's been a lot of consensus trades and sort of what Leslie alluded to in terms of, for the past year, the Fed's been on hold, the rates have been kind of stable. It's pushed investors to, for example, do the carry trade where they're borrowing in Japan at very low rates, converting it to another currency to invest at a higher yield. So very consensus trade. The Mag 7, these technology stocks, a lot of investors, especially say hedge funds, kind of crowded into them, a consensus trade. So kind of to use analogy, a lot of people kind of went into one room of a house and now all of a sudden someone pulled the fire alarm and everyone wants to run out very quickly. And when that happens, one, either like things kind of cascade or things kind of break down and you can get big dislocations. So that's kind of the dynamic across multiple financial markets. It's also the case that there's a little bit of, the butterfly flaps its wings over there and something else happens here. So for gold, for example, you're right that it's sort of counterintuitive on a day where there's a flight to safety, yields were going lower. Why is the price of gold, typically a safe asset, lower? well, there's some evidence of traders who have lost money in other positions like equities have to cover those by selling gold positions. And it's like, you know, the knock-on effect of I can't easily get rid of the equities, but I can sell the gold. So I think there's some dynamics like that where, you know, again, something that you don't think is impacting one market could be actually impacting the other market. The Japanese yen is a good example of that. It was this consensus carry trade for a long period of time. As both the Bank of Japan and the Fed policy rates start to shift, that makes that carry trade less attractive. When it unwinds, everyone's moving in a very fast direction. And we've seen Japanese equities in local terms down almost 24% in about a month. The yen has moved about 14% in just a matter of a couple of weeks against reflecting this kind of crowded position. Now, when we look across the landscape, when you get these kind of moves, a lot of chop, and it's a lot of sort of position-driven adjustments, you'll get dislocations. And when you get dislocations, it creates opportunities whereby the price of an asset starts to disconnect from its fundamentals. And I think we've talked about some of these ideas in Lesley and fixed income and equities. And so definitely we're looking at things like that, like Japanese equities look relatively attractive, but it can actually get worse before it gets better. So I think that we're in a process of like identifying things where there's pockets of opportunities. We've discussed some of them today. I think gold is an example where there's a structural tailwind for gold to go higher, because central banks just want to diversify their holdings. But could it rally in the interim or sell off more so in this turbulence? It's hard to say. But I think this is kind of what's creating these opportunities. And so as things start to come down, that's a good opportunity to kind of adjust, add, or sort of shift your portfolio overall.
Okay. What I'm hearing is we already like gold. We've liked gold since last year. And this recent sell-off is probably another opportunity to add in. But obviously, we're in the middle of a lot of repositioning. What I'm also hearing is from you, we're getting ready to add more to maybe Japanese equities, but yet to see. We're not doing anything, right?
I would say the risk-reward for a lot of asset classes has actually gotten better, not worse, over the past few weeks. The question is, where do you want to take advantage of that?
Risk score getting more interesting in high yield, not so much in duration.
Not so much in duration.
Trimming there. Energy, we got to wait. But technology don't have to wait that much.
Yep.
It's already, the opportunity is already there. Okay, and our base case scenario around economy and soft landing is intact for now. I would love to get a few questions from our clients, and I'm seeing already a ton being listed here. I guess I'm going to start with the equities. If we do see a worst case scenario, if we do see a worst case recession, not just a recession, but a worst-case recession, what would happen to equities? Another 20%?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. We probably would see about 20% further downside. I also don't think the recession would be terribly bad because, as we were talking about, we don't really see a lot of imbalances in the economy. There haven't been big pockets of overinvestment. That's what it affected and made the financial crisis so painful, and the financial system itself was over-leveraged, and we don't have anything like that today. We talked about, consumer balance sheets are generally pretty healthy. Corporate balance sheets also pretty healthy. So I don't think it's going to be, I don't think the recession would be terrible. I think the main thing restraining the economy right now, to the extent that it seems like it is these higher interest rates from the Fed. And with slower growth and the inflation story being better, we can start dialing those back. But I think something in the low 4,000s on the S&P, I think it's a reasonable recession scenario. But obviously, we need to, talk about the precise nature of the recession that we could potentially be in.
Thanks. Another question is around the yen carry trade. What is the impact of the yen carry trade? I guess its impact on across, I'm going to say, multiple asset classes. We already talked about this briefly in terms of how yen carry trade is usually put on during low volatility environments, and then when volatility picks up, that's one of the first things you turn around and you unwind, and then you take whatever your position that was making money. But Lizzie, I'm going to turn this question to you because you've been watching, obviously, Bank of Japan very closely. The first impact is happening, obviously, in the rates market, but then obviously it spills into Japanese equities and AI stocks, you name it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're seeing some of that impact right now. I think Jason mentioned it also, is that, when you have the ability to borrow at such low rates, to cash low rates like they did, in Japan and invest, say, in the U.S., a lot of this has been A bit of an unwind, given how much the the fixed income market and how much the pricing in the Fed, which obviously affects our dollar. So a lot of that has been moving around a bit in terms of that unwind. But I think it's mostly given the fact that we had this sort of growth scare, a large move in the Fed funds rate, which has sort of realigned that kind of that carry trade going forward. And now you're seeing a little bit of forced selling.
I mean, we were chatting about this earlier, yeah. Right? And you were making the point, Leslie, that when you see these types of unwinds, they tend to happen pretty quickly. They don't really persist.
Yeah. That's right. And that was part of the point that we were trying to make. Normally when you have that kind of move that what you had yesterday, someone has a margin call and it kind of goes, and then we have retail getting involved, but it's something normally that doesn't last for 5-6 days. So you normally have these large shock moves, and which is what we're seeing right now. Now with that said, again, when it comes to the U.S. Treasury side, although we do think this is a bit overdone, you can't say we won't go to 2 or 3.5 because, again, if the equity market is involved and you have that flight to quality, it won't matter the level of rates. All you're thinking about is principal protection, capital preservation, right? So the level of rates, that won't necessarily matter. Yeah.
Okay. I want to end on a good note, but the questions are on war, so let's see. How would a bigger war in Middle East impact your outlook? Jason, maybe you and I can tackle this, but I mean, the way I look at it, this war in Middle East has been going on for, it's going to be in almost a year in October. It certainly has intensified over the last 2 weeks, and yet, just I mentioned a little while ago, oil is down 12% in the last 30 days. So let's talk about how it would impact the outlook, but I don't think this sell-off that we're seeing has anything to do with it.
No, so I think the challenge with any sort of geopolitical event is like, one, putting a probability on it, but ultimately, which is really difficult to do, but then you wanna kind of bring it back to like, well, what's the actual economic impact for the US economy? And what we've seen thus far is it's probably very little, what's happened since last October. And the real impact, of course, is if there's any sort of disruptions in the supply of oil, and therefore oil prices start to surge, to go over $100, $120 a barrel. Because then what people are paying at the pump is impacted, consumer spending can be impacted. Typically, that is a drag on the U.S. economy. Now, one thing that's actually changed for the U.S. economy is that the U.S. is the actual biggest producer of oil on a daily basis. And so there's parts of the economy that actually benefit from higher oil prices. So the net effect for the overall economy used to be really negative. Now it's a little bit more balanced. But given the overall kind of health of the economy where things stand, it would take a pretty dramatic price shock to disrupt it. And then you have to kind of calibrate what's the likelihood of something like that happening. It's certainly not zero, but it's not large enough that I think clearly the markets kind of looked past that. They focused on other factors. So I think it would take a really big escalation to cause kind of a risk-off environment. And then you're probably not dealing with just the supply of oil, but other geopolitical tensions as various groups and entities around the world are kind of positioning themselves. So I think that's, it would take a pretty big escalation, I think, to really disrupt the economic outlook and the market outlook.
Okay. One more question. Well, actually, I'm going to ask the other one quick. Should we stay in short duration? Because, Leslie, you were talking about trimming duration in portfolios, but what does that actually mean? We're not going to 2-year duration, right? Maybe we just be more specific about
that. That's absolutely right. We're not short duration. As Leda pointed out, the recommendation would add at about that 4.5 level, we would trim that long, but we wouldn't necessarily go short. Now, if your question is about what part of the curve, because of the fact we've said the yield curve was going to bull steepen, that short end going down. Would I buy a 2-year here? No, I wouldn't. But what we have is, on the whole portfolio perspective, we have kept it around that 4.5-5-year area, that belly, and we're going to stay there for now. We are. We're going to keep it at that level, but we've trimmed a little bit. That's all. We trimmed some of what we bought when interest rates are higher, say post debate or around that 4-4.5 level.
Okay, great. One last question. Actually, I'm curious. Maybe we'll do a yes, no. Everybody on this one. I guess that's what makes market. But is any of this volatility related to the current political situation in the U.S.? Okay, I'll answer for us. I don't think so. I think it's just coincident that VP Harris is pulling ahead in some of the polls, but I don't believe any of this sell-off is related to politics. But who knows? Maybe you guys think differently.
I would generally agree with that. I think it's maybe a very small portion, but I do think it's worth... first of all, investors don't like uncertainty, and I think the election has become more uncertain. But I don't think it's been a big driver. But I would highlight, if we are looking at a blue sweep situation, corporate taxes are probably going up, and that's probably not going to be equity market friendly. So that's definitely in the mix to some extent.
I would also be in your camp of this is not really. I think there's other factors. You know, the economic environment, the growth environment, what the Fed is going to do are far more dominant than the politics, certainly in the U.S. at this point in time.
Yeah, I agree. I say no, too. That volatility is yet to come.
Yeah. Clearly, we're on the same team. All right, great. We have only this much time. We want to be, no more than 40 minutes here in the interest of time. But thank you for joining us today. We hope this helped provide clarity into the latest market moves and what to do going forward. We'll continue to keep you updated in the coming days, weeks, and months. And as always, I encourage you to continue the discussion with your UBS financial advisor. Thank you. Have a great day.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.